It's a great pleasure to welcome to this forum David Koenig. He is founder of Bright Governance based in Northfield, Minnesota. David's work over the past 4 decades has been focused on helping organizations to be more successful in achieving their goals. He served on multiple for-profit and nonprofit boards and has advised board members and executives around the world. His executive leadership roles have included the creation and development of corporate risk management programs at 3 different companies, the management of complex portfolios in excess of tens of billions of dollars in size, the risk oversight of a complete suite of public mutual funds for one of the largest banks in the US, and the development of the first firm-wide risk management program in the mortgage banking business. David does hold an MA in economics from Northwestern University and BA degrees in mathematics and economics from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. The subject of today's conversation is David's terrific book on corporate on governance, titled "Governance Reimagined: Organizational Design, Risk, and Value Creation." And David, at the outset, I'd love to hear what inspired you to write the book.
Well, John, first off, thank you for inviting me to join you. It's been a pleasure to learn about your organization and to be invited to be part of this. It sounds like it's a great event in the way in which you've organized things. The book is really an accumulation of the things that I've experienced and learned, both going back to my school days as well as through the different careers paths that I've taken, the different companies that I've worked for, and looking at how organizations can best take risk. I like to use that expression in terms of what organizations do because everything has to be about taking a risk if you want to achieve something. And I've seen too many cases where people who are engaged in risk management, or what they call risk management, use it in only a defensive approach. In other words, trying to avoid losses. And to me, that's always seemed suboptimal. So in writing the book, what I tried to do is put together a reasonably coherent path to understanding, A, how risk affects us in our decision making, but B, also how people tend to make decisions and collaborate well together so that we get an appreciation of risk both as having an upside and a downside. We're focused on the upside because that's why any organization exists, is to achieve some goals, and not to allow the downside of risk to keep you from making decisions well. So this is probably the best way to describe it. It's just accumulation of everything that I had learned through my work, and then some new discoveries when I was out doing research for the book, trying to fill in some gaps for things that still didn't make sense to me, particularly from my days in graduate school. So hopefully that gives you a good sense. I think one thing it's important to mention is this now is the first in a series of 3 books. That'll be examining how we work together. So it was a good launching place, and hopefully people enjoy it.
And what would you say is the core message of this book?
Well, it's how we work together and that we can work well together collaboratively. There are ways that we can structure our organizations so that collaboration is enhanced. There are ways that we can structure our organizations so that the downside to risk taking is minimized. Resiliency is a word that you hear. I think Nassim Taleb uses the term anti-fragility. Also, understanding that people's perceptions of us matter for our overall value. So, if you ask yourself, what am I worth or what is the value of my organization? In many ways, that's determined by how well you can fulfill the transparent goals that you have. If you have transparent goals that people support, you'll be more valuable. If you provide something of value to someone, they'll be willing to exchange more to get that. So this book is really about how do you make yourself more valuable in pursuit of those goals.
And tell us a little bit about the structure of the book and what is really the target reader audience?
Well, you know, it's somebody had asked me once about that in terms of a target audience. This is really for anybody. I mean, one of the examples that I put in the book is that this structure of governance can be applied to throwing a party at your home. You want that to be successful. If your goal is to have a good party, you want people to come back the next time you have a party. So it can be particularly simple like that, or it can be as complex as political economies. So there really isn't an audience where you would say this isn't appropriate for them. It is not a how-to book in the sense that there are 10 steps here, do these 10 things and everything will work fine for you. I don't try to pretend that that's something you can do. Rather, it's a framework and a mindset with some specific recommendations, but to operate within that framework and mindset will allow you to achieve the goals that you're pursuing. So it's not just board members, although board members tend to be focused on governance issues. It's anybody who's doing anything where they want some objective to be realized well.
You write about systems and networks in our lives. Tell us a little bit more about that and what you mean by secret agents.
So I suppose just trying to be clever. You know, systems and networks aren't necessarily part of everyone's conversation. But as soon as you start looking at systems theory, particularly how complex systems work, and we can talk a little bit about the difference between complex and complicated systems. But when you start to look at how complex systems work, once you do, you can't look at anything else that you encounter in your life without seeing systems in place. So one of the examples that I give in the book is the system of getting you a cup of coffee in the morning. Most people who drink coffee have a place that they usually go to get their cup of coffee, and they generally do that in a fairly mindless way, whether it's walking into the store, driving up to a drive-thru, whatever it may be. But there are an amazing number of systems that take place in action prior to your even arriving to get that cup of coffee. And then once you've purchased that cup of coffee, there are an amazing number of systems that are kicked into place and kicked into action after that to make sure that tomorrow when you come back, or the person who comes in after you, or the person who comes in a week, has a system that works very effectively to deliver to them what they want. Again, that seems like a very simple thing, this idea of getting a good cup of coffee. But it is amazing the number of systems that take place or that have to be in place in order for you to have that delivered to you. So systems and networks. Networks are really a graphical representation of systems. They make it easier for us to understand how these systems work. One other example I have in the book is to talk about the game 6 Degrees of Separation from Kevin Bacon. So some people in your audience will know him as a movie star, but here in the States, there's a game called 6 Degrees of Separation where you try to connect any Hollywood figure or any person to Kevin Bacon in less than 6 connections. Well, most of us have a network like that, but explaining that, you know, in sort of a verbal way as opposed to a graphical way is more difficult. But the graphical representation is network theory and shows us A, the types of relationships we have, as well as the power of those relationships. And that information is essential for how we set up, again, our organizations to best achieve our goals.
What is the distinction between complex and complicated?
I think there's a generally agreed to definition that's similar to what I'm going to say here, although I'm sure it's not everyone's definition. Complicated systems are systems that when you take them apart and look at all the parts separately, you don't have anything less than existed at the start. So a car, for example, is one I use in the book to describe a complicated system. Most of us couldn't build a car on our own. And most of us, if we took a car apart and tried to put it back together, probably couldn't do it. But if we were able to, we wouldn't have anything different than when we had the parts apart. It's still a car. Complex systems, on the other hand, are ones where we have interacting parts. A lot of those are people, but they could be technologies and resources, that something more emerges than the sum of the parts. So we can talk about that in terms of new ideas. We can talk about it in terms of products that come out of it. But what they are in essence is a collective action where capital is used in lots of different forms, but that there's more there. So if you tear them down into their component parts, you have less than the whole.
Can we talk a little bit about the emergence of complexity economics and what's wrong with traditional economics?
Yeah, I'll get myself in some trouble generally focused on what's wrong with traditional economics, but I'll go back to what I was schooled in the 1980s. And that was really in this focus on the free market. Now, the free market's pretty powerful, but one of the problems is that the free market became, in essence, a god, for lack of a better term, became a market god, and that people just started to default to these ideas of saying, well, let the market decide. My first career was in the financial markets, which are among some of the freest markets in the world. And what I discovered in that work was that markets weren't as pure and perfect as what was led to believe in the graduate studies that I had done. There were lots of things that happened in the markets that shouldn't have happened according to the theory of the day. And this whole notion of taking free markets and just letting go and letting them do what they do, we wind up getting all sorts of human actions and human interactions and emotional responses that cause a lot of damage that doesn't necessarily need to be there. Complexity economics, on the other hand, comes out of this area of complexity science. So complexity science had its birth at a place called the Santa Fe Institute, Santa Fe, New Mexico. It came about when a number of physicists and economists and other people of high standing in their academic worlds got together to talk about difficult problems. In particular, they were interested in difficult economic problems. And the physicists, as was reported by the people who were there, were pretty impressed by how difficult economic problems are to solve. And they were really interested at the time, and this was again in the late 80s, I believe, they were really interested in the time how economists were trying to turn a social science into a hard science by using all sorts of mathematical models to explain these behaviors. The problem from the physicist's standpoint was that the models that were being used were old models that the physicists had used 100 years before. And it was described as like a visit to Cuba, where there had been an intellectual embargo and they'd missed everything that had been done in physics in the last 100 years. That's a little bit harsh, and my understanding is that the economists didn't like that critique. But what came out of that, rather than people walking away and saying, I don't like them and I don't agree with them, was this initiative to try and understand how economic systems work better. So at the Santa Fe Institute, complexity is applied across natural systems and as well as economic systems. And complexity economics is a focus on how value is created. So for us, when we talk about these complex systems, there are two things. One, value created is that part that emerges, where I'd mentioned before in terms of complex systems, there's something more there than the sum of the parts. That's the value that's created. That's something that comes out of capital. And the other thing in terms of how they look at this from an economic standpoint is to say, how do we do efficient allocation of resources? Again, that gets back to this idea that the markets are the best way to allocate these things. But when we look at complex adaptive systems, we can find that there are better ways than just purely saying let the market decide. Areas of collaboration, again, an understanding about how systems can be resilient, which allows for there to be some form of intervention. So if you take two schools of economics, the one that was very much towards this market god mindset, and the other school of economics, which was more akin to the Keynesian model, where there's lots of hierarchical intervention, what we find is that there is actually a hybrid between those. Sometimes more markets and less hierarchy, sometimes more hierarchy and less markets, but it's not a choice between either, it's a choice of how much. And I think that's one of the areas that complexity economics has been doing a really good job of helping us to understand better.
Let's talk a little bit about governance within enterprises. Who are typically the stakeholders there, and what is the governance problem, if you will, in an enterprise?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because people always talk about governance problems, and I think that governance problems usually are something that come about because there's something else that's going on, usually a misunderstanding of the culture of the organization or a culture that isn't aligned with what people had expected. So governance, again, is about how you best pursue the transparent objectives you have. So whether you're a publicly traded company, a church, a neighborhood group, whatever it might be, if you have these transparent objectives, then governance is about how you structure yourself in order to best achieve those objectives. So in terms of a question about problems, it's really saying, are we in a place that we can achieve these goals and do so in a way that people understand? And I apologize because you had just asked something else about the governance problems, and I don't think I addressed that. But if you could refresh my memory, I'd be happy to try and address that too.
I think I was referring to the various stakeholders in an organization. And I think by problem, what I really meant was the challenge that's at the heart of an organization like that that needs to be addressed through governance.
So the challenge is the best use of resources that are scarce. I mean, and scarce resources cut across financial as well as human and technological resources that are available. You know, in terms of the type of stakeholder we have, it's anyone who touches the organization. So we can think of the most obvious ones being customers. So without customers, you don't have a business. There's no one paying you for your service. You'll go away very quickly. But they also include board members. They also include suppliers. They include employees. They include potential employees. They include regulators. They include stockholders, bondholders, people in the communities in which you operate. It's a very broad swath of people, most of which have an interest in seeing you succeed. So when we don't incorporate those stakeholders, and I suppose you could argue that this is a bit of a governance problem, if you don't incorporate the views of all of those stakeholders, you're missing out on an awful lot of people who are interested in seeing you do well. You don't have to agree with everything a stakeholder says you should do, but there should be a method through your governance to get that input. And one of the things I outline in the book is this idea of formally engaging stakeholders in the board level governance of the organization. They don't necessarily have to be board members, although you'll see people who sit on boards of organizations who represent different stakeholder groups. They can actually be parts of stakeholder committees or in some cases watchdog boards that keep an eye on what the board of directors is doing. So it's a broad group, but what I would say it's anyone who touches the organization at any place in the organization's pursuit of its objectives.
Sometimes there's tension between the interests of various stakeholders, let's say shareholders versus employees. Mm-hmm. How does one think about that?
Again, it depends on the structure of the organization. So if we're talking about a publicly traded company, then there is an obligation to the shareholders. So the board has that fiduciary obligation. The argument would have to be back that listening to customers or listening to employees or some other stakeholder group that has a particular interest is best for the long run value of the organization. Now, I know there's a lot of economic debate about whether the long run value is appropriate for a board to be focused on, because if you make a decision today that temporarily affects the value of the company today, you can argue that then you have not served the interests of those shareholders who want to sell the company tomorrow. So it's a delicate balance, but that's again one of the roles that the board has. So a board of directors is given this responsibility and they're protected by law in order to make decisions using their best judgment. But I think they have to balance it, and the evidence seems to suggest that if you're doing things in the long run that increase trust in your company, that increase the use of capital and the effectiveness of the use of capital, that you'll be rewarded for that in the short term as well as the long term as the markets start to understand your approach. So I think ultimately it comes down to the interest of the long run will wind up being in the interest of the short run as well in terms of valuation.
What is the role of trust in networks, and how is trust typically won or lost?
Well, it's easy to lose trust. So trust is lost anytime you don't meet expectations. I go in for that cup of coffee and they don't have the particular coffee I'm looking for. I go in for that cup of coffee and it comes to me and it's cold. If that's the case and that happens a couple of times, I may never come back to that coffee shop. So trust has now broken that economic relationship I have. At the same time, if I'm a stockholder, take a much bigger picture, or an employee of a company, take a much bigger picture in that regard. And what's been promised to me, again, in the transparent goals and the way in which an organization is pursuing its objectives, turns out not to be true. I have a substantial violation of the trust that I've put in that organization. So the next time that I want to consider an investment in that company, for example, from the stockholder standpoint, I'm going to demand a higher return. If I demand a higher return, then my cost of capital of the organization has gone up, and that means that the organization can't realize the same level of profitability that it would have if that trust hadn't been broken. In terms of employees, if trust is broken among employees by, say, removing a benefit that was expected, a pension obligation that isn't met, then future employees are going to be have to be paid more, and the effort to bring those employees in is going to cost more for the organization. Again, that impacts its overall performance. So trust is essential for any relationships that we have. In fact, there's an argument that trust is inversely related to the amount of legal documentation that's required for any relationship. The ultimate trust in a relationship is that I say to you, I'll do this, and you say, that's great, and you walk away. Maybe there's a handshake. When you get into places where you have thousands of pages of legal documents, you're in a situation where you don't have as much trust. And that has a cost. There's a drag to productivity. There's a true financial cost in having to draw out all those legal negotiations. And anyone who's been involved in those two different kinds of relationships knows exactly what I'm talking about. But trust has to be there so I can share ideas. If I want to collaborate with people in the organization, I want to know that the ideas I share are ones that are going to be valued and not taken by somebody else, or credit taken by somebody else for those. I want to know that the organization is going to reward me for these ideas that I bring forward. I want to trust that the people I'm working with are going to do the things that they say they're going to do. And that way, I don't feel like I have to keep an eye on them as closely as I might if I didn't trust them. So in essence, trust removes friction. Lack of trust increases friction and cost. So it's critically important, and it's the central part of the book. If you read the book, it's right in the middle of the book, because that's a central theme and a transition to the overall structure of governance that's discussed in the book.
You also share insights into the things that motivate people. Tell us a little bit about the so-called Darley's Law.
Yeah, well, Darley's Law, and I mentioned earlier about culture. One of the things about Darley's Law, and this is John Darley, who is a retired professor from Princeton, psychology professor. I was introduced to him by a colleague named Chuck Huff, who's a psychology professor here in Northfield at St. Olaf College. And John Darley's work looks at how people behave individually as opposed to in groups, and the types of things that can be done to make people do things that you wouldn't expect. Now, we can look at political cases, for example, when there might be a person, a leader, or someone who's engaged in behaviors that people find offensive, and yet you see others seeming not to care or seeming to go along with those things, even if you ask them separately whether those views are consistent with their moral values, they would say no, they don't do anything about it. And part of that is because the culture is validating that behavior. The culture is rewarding that. So in Darley's world, we look at whether the incentive compensation that's paid is telling people something different than, say, the organization's words around what's supposed to be done. That's pretty common in the financial markets. We've seen that kind of behavior. It's pretty common around the years leading up to the subprime crisis, people being paid for things that weren't necessarily in the interests of the company in the long run. So John Darley's work really looks at how people can be, I don't want to say tricked, but somehow be doing things that you wouldn't expect of them because the messages that they're receiving are different in terms of financial compensation than the messages they're receiving in, say, in terms of a moral authority or moral directive that the organization is giving.
When it comes to networked or distributive governance, particularly as it relates, say, to boards of directors. Talk to us a little bit about some of the issues there, perhaps principal agent or incentives or simply human nature, as it were, when it comes to not wanting to rock the boat and wanting to be sociable within such a setting.
Well, and I think you just talked about compensation when we were talking about Darley's Law. In terms of a networked and distributive form of governance, there are really three things that I bring together in the book here. Let's first touch on the distributive form of governance. That's based on a model by the Carvers. It's called the Carver Method, which is the idea that your best source of innovation and your best source of getting work done is to try and push out authority as far as you can and as close as you can to the stakeholders in an organization. So within the Carver model, an organization sets big goals and then it sets rules that tell you what you can't do in pursuit of those goals. So one of those rules might be don't do anything illegal. That's a broad goal. And then you're allowed to do anything that doesn't contradict those restrictions that you've got in pursuit of the goals. So that then is carried down further and further into the organization, so that each level of the organization, there's something they call a nested policy box, where you can set another set of objectives and rules that are a subset of the rules that were set for you at the higher level of the organization. So you keep pushing this out, and what you wind up doing is granting freedom to people to pursue the objectives as best they can, subject to the constraints of the rules. That's the distributive model. Now, there's some problems with that, because you may not be doing in the end the things that you expect that you're doing. So there's a gentleman named Shan Turnbull, based in Australia, and Shan has developed something called network governance. Now, I mentioned earlier stakeholders and how they might play a formal role in an organization through a stakeholder board or some sort of watchdog board. That comes right out of Shan's work. So his idea is that these people who have a great interest in what you're doing as an organization should be formally included in the overall governance of the organization, both as ways to bring you ideas, but also to escalate and elevate things to you that are going wrong. So let's take the subprime crisis again. If you had had some stakeholders, part of some of these lending organizations, raising issues to the board about what was happening, maybe there would have been some withdrawal of the amount of lending that was being done, or maybe some increase in the credit quality of people to whom loans were being made. That's an essential part of keeping this distributive model, which, say, allowed loan originators to continue originating loans, to be checked, so that they don't just go off in this form of whatever they're being paid to do. So close a loan, get paid, close a loan, get paid, close a loan, get paid, isn't the same thing as saying making sure you're doing a good loan that ultimately the organization benefits in the long run, and so does the customer. I go one step further than those and start to look at this notion of commons government and commons management, which is to say, what kinds of commons do we have? A commons is a shared resource, a resource that people have access to. Most people know commons like the air, maybe a lake, maybe a field where animals graze. Those are commons that are typically described. But what I look at in this is the ability to pursue your objectives as a commons. So the capital that you have, the ability to take risk, if you start to treat that as a commons, you can start to implement rules around successful commons management that further enhance this notion of network and distributed governance. So what I can do is say, I'm going to give more and more freedom to people to pursue ideas. I'm going to have people out there who are part of my network keeping an eye on them and reporting back and giving us feedback so we can do it better and letting us know when some things aren't going as we expect. And then finally, when I've got these rules set up, I can allow the organization to be, in essence, its own complex adaptive system, changing as needed without some single CEO saying we should do this or a board saying this is exactly what we should do. It can take an organization off in a direction that it had never expected, but that's part of what we need to do in order for organizations to survive. So that's the model that I've put forward. It does begin with this network and distributive model, but then it adds on this notion of thinking about our organization as a commons.
David, before we wrap it up, I'd love to hear a little bit more about the two new books you are working on, A Board Member's Guide to Risk and God's Portfolio. I believe those two books will be out in 2020. What is the impetus for the books and the key message you want to get across?
Yeah, so I'll mention a third one as well, because I'd mentioned at the start of this discussion that the Governance Reimagined is the first in a three-book series. So the second book is God's Portfolio, and that's another examination of how we relate to each other. So the first section in that book is called The I, as in a capital letter I, and asks about whether our selfish interests or self-pursuits are ideal and where those can go wrong, because that's fundamentally part of a free market mindset about economics, is that it's a pursuit of self-interest. The second section is a focus on the we. How do we work collectively? How is it that we collaborate? And where can that go wrong? And then the third part is on the all, which is saying, what are some of the bigger things that we relate to? The economy, the environment, our planet, even to ask questions about God and what does God mean to people and how do those first things, how we relate to ourselves and to groups, relate back to some of our beliefs in a bigger power. That's going to transition into a third book called Capitalism Reimagined, which asks the question about whether we consider or whether we've stopped asking ourselves what capital is, whether we're so comfortable with what capital means that we no longer challenge the idea. And this is not to say that the free market is bad. It's not to say our current views of capital are bad, but maybe we should be thinking about some things that are not particularly measurable, like how effectively we can collaborate with each other as another form of capital. And if we're not incorporating that, maybe we're not making the best decisions. So God's Portfolio is going to be a challenging book. I've started writing that. I've got the outline for it. 2020 is something I certainly hope that it's ready in. But I will just tell you, there's a lot of work into that book. So we'll keep progressing on it. You had mentioned the Board Guide to Risk, Board Member's Guide to Risk. As I mentioned early on, Governance Reimagined is not a how-to book in the sense that here are 10 steps to follow. It is a how-to book in terms of general structuring and helping people to understand why you want to structure your organization in a particular way. But a Board Member's Guide to Risk is intended to be very practical. So I ran an organization called the Directors and Chief Risk Officers Group. It's something that I started, I think, right around the time of the financial crisis. And the idea there was to develop practical guides for boards around risk-taking, around compensation, around risk committees, around putting people on your board that understand risk. So what I want to do is assemble a book that talks about things that boards specifically can do. So in essence, it will be that how-to guide for boards to be able to take risk well, trying to avoid where risk makes you make bad decisions, trying to understand how you can make capital less expensive, how you can develop trust, as you had asked about earlier, and practically put that in place at the board level. So that's going to be one that is hopefully a little easier to write because it's what I do in my work. But it's outside of this three-book series, but it should be something that people can use in their own work.
Terrific. Well, David, thank you so much for taking the time to be here and talk to us not only about Governance Reimagined, but also preview your forthcoming books. We truly appreciate it.
John, I appreciate it. Good to be with you and look forward to having a chance to meet in person someday.
Absolutely. Goodbye for now.
Cheers.